Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
The secret ballot was not the way they voted in early America. Most people voted by voice. You would arrive at the poll and then you would say out loud, sometimes in front of a crowd, I want to vote for X or Y. And in one sense, it was very embarrassing because I did it. I went into my New York City cafeteria of a public school and I said, I'd like to vote for Kathy Hochul for governor. I said it right out loud. And the woman who worked at the polls was like, shh, 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 you can't say that. That is not allowed. You've got this is. And I said, well, that's the way our founding fathers voted. And she said, times have changed.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. AJ, welcome back to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I am delighted to be back. Thank you, Srini.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you back here. So you have a new book out called A Year of Living Constitutionally, all of which we will get into. And I was just looking back at the transcript to see what I had asked you last time you were here to make sure I didn't ask the same question. But I want to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've ended up being with your life and your career?
Well, that's a lovely question. I always love these opening questions. So I was intrigued to see. Well, let me give you two quick ones from my dad. I remember I was like maybe 12 or so, and I was playing squash with him and I lost a point and I was a jerk. I was very immature. So I threw my racket and I started cursing, and he said, listen, he wasn't angry. He just said, listen, you have got to try. You're only here once. Life is very short. Really just try to enjoy every second. And I love that, the sort of Epicurean way of life. You've got to really enjoy it. And this idea of losing a point in squash is not worth getting angry about. That's not going to make my life better. And let me give you one other, which was, that my father, we were on a road trip and we had to go to the bathroom really badly. And we stopped at a hotel and used their bathroom, but my father gave the hotel a dollar or two because he said, you know, we used their napkins, we used their water, we took up a little bit of their resources. So we shouldn't just take it without giving them something. And it's a little over the top, I think. But I love the idea. I love the idea of being so mindful of others that you would leave money for using their paper towels in the bathroom.
Yeah. Well, your books make so much more sense now when after you're telling me the your little John McEnroe moment.
Was a super brat. Just without the talent.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, that sounds very like a John McEnroe moment for a teen.
That's exactly it. Yeah, he needed some cognitive behavioral therapy. I think he could have really benefited.
Yeah. Well, instead, he got to become a tennis superstar and narrate a TV show on Netflix.
That is true.
The wrong lesson people learned from that. It's like, oh, so that's, you know, that's what happened if you have that kind of a temper.
Right. Unfortunately, our society does seem to reward outrage and tantrums. So,
yeah.
But I don't think it's good for you or society. So
yeah.
I say be more like Bjorn Borg, who no one remembers, but who was very calm.
Well, you know, the thing that strikes me most, I mean, you talk about this idea of living, you know, enjoying every moment. And it seems like this is a running theme through a lot of the work that you do. Like, I'm really curious how you go about choosing. You did the Year of Living Biblically, and there were some pretty funny references to that. But how do you decide? Like, what made you think, okay, you know what? What I want to do is live by the original words of the Constitution for you.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I have lots of ideas. We talked about this last time, which I also listened to because I didn't want to repeat myself.
Yeah.
And we had a lovely conversation, by the way, folks, if you haven't heard it. I enjoyed it. And I hope you will, too. But this one might even be better. So I guess I have a lot of ideas, and a lot of them are not that good. So but I do believe it's a numbers game. I think that you have to be creative, you have to just come up with tons of ideas and find those jewels among the mud or whatever the metaphor might be. And for me, one way to tell what might resonate with others is if it has something really impactful to say about what's going on today. So, you know, I could write a book about learning to play the French horn. I might even enjoy trying to become the best French horn player. Wait, weren't you a tuba player?
I was.
That's funny. I could become a tuba player. That might be but I'll leave that to you. But to me, that's not my passion. Instead, I wanted to do something that had real relevance to me and to others. So for this Constitution book, I knew very little about the Constitution. I had not even read it. I knew the preamble from Schoolhouse Rock. Mm. That might date me. But I had never read it from top to bottom. But every day when I opened the news, there was another article about how the Constitution was affecting my life in a real way and millions of others. And I said, you know what? I would really like to understand this more. And the way I like to understand things is by dive in and live them and walk the walk and talk the talk and carry the musket and wear the buckled shoes and wear the tricorn hat and really quarter the soldiers in my apartment, just really go all in to try to understand this document and how we should treat it today. And hopefully by the end, my hope was I would feel a little bit more empowered, a little bit better about democracy, which mm-hmm. is something, because you read the news, it's very depressing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it did. I think it made me much more optimistic in it. And I feel much more empowered, and I feel like I understand it. It's complicated, but I feel I understand it much more than I did.
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that strikes me about you saying that, like, I've lived in the United States since 1986, and I don't think I'm alone. I'm guessing even most American-born citizens who've been here their entire lives couldn't tell you a damn thing about what is actually in the Constitution. You know, like,
right.
We know about the Second Amendment because it's in the news all the time. Every day there's a shooting. So we're like, okay, that's, you know, something we know about. Based on this, like, one of the things I'm really curious about is you made a bit of reference to it in the book about how we teach this in school, because I took AP American History. I didn't know a damn thing about any of the things I read about in your book. Like, literally,
oh,
I was
really?
Like, oh, wow, this is mind boggling. Like, yeah, I don't remember it because I wasn't paying attention.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I think, Yeah, we definitely don't teach it in an interesting way. I think we either sort of worship it as this this divine set of parchment pages dictated by these demigods, or we focus on the downsides that it was written by some men who own, some of them who own slaves. And but it's neat, it's a complicated document. It's got good and it's got bad.
Yeah.
It's like I like one of my advisors, this Harvard professor Larry Tribe, said it's like quantum mechanics. It's both a wave and a particle. It's both a document of oppression and elitism, but it also has these strains of democracy and freedom and equality. So it's up to us to roll up our sleeves and try to focus on the latter, mm-hmm. and try to make it live up to its best ideals. Like Frederick Douglass says, it's a promissory note. It's a promissory note, and America has not always lived up to it.
Yeah, I saw this documentary once. I think it was, it might have been A World in Disarray, or it might have been a documentary with Obama on Vice News, where he and some journalists were talking about this idea that democracy is an ideal that we have been trying to live up to. Like, you know, it's not set in stone. But I think that as weird as this is, let's talk about the beginning, like the actual creation of this document that effectively has kind of shaped our history as a country.
Yeah. I mean, well, in the beginning, it was not necessarily that democratic, because it was, first of all, only white men could vote. So it has been sort of a struggle over the decades and centuries to try to expand we the people to mean actually we all the people, except for people under 18.
Yeah.
They don't count. There are actual movements of people who want to have kids vote. I don't think they've gotten very far.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, it has been. And the beginning, it's very interesting. One of the most fascinating things about reading about the beginning was how fluid the ideas were. We look back and we think, okay, this is the way it was supposed to be. This is sort of the default of way a democracy looks. But no, you read about the Constitutional Convention and they had all these wacky ideas that if just a few people had voted differently, we would be living in a world with three presidents, mm-hmm. not just one president, but three presidents. You would have, you know, Donald Trump and Mitt Romney and Joe Biden all as president. It might be crazy. There was a movement to get rid of states, because states is a weird idea. How can you have two governments? Why is there a state government and a federal government? How can you serve two masters, is what one of the delegates said. So this this idea of fluidity and flexibility and entrepreneurship among the founding fathers is one I love, because I think we get stuck and are very rigid. But one of the things I really admire, and they have their flaws, they have their good and their bad, but one of the parts that I admire is how flexible they were, how willing, and we talked about this last time, the importance of being flexible, changing your mind, being open. One of my favorite quotes from Ben Franklin at the Constitution, he said, at the convention, he said, "The older I get, the less certain I am of my opinions," which I love. And I also love the very last words of James Madison, the father of the Constitution. He was on his deathbed, and he said to his niece, he said, "Oh, I changed my mind." And she's like, "What about what?" And he died. So we'll never know. It could be about Congress. It could be about soup. Who knows what it was? But just the fact that these people were so willing to evolve and change and argue and not be so staunchly dug in to their opinions that nothing will budge them, which is where we are at now with politics. It's so tribal and so stuck in, and not just politics, but culture at large. We all, and I speak for myself too, are very hard to get us to evolve and change our minds. I'm trying to change that for myself, but that is a huge problem that we face.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, do you think there's a solution to that problem? Because it seems like it's just getting worse and worse day by day. Like I don't remember. I was watching something the other night on the news. No, it was about media and truth. It was some YouTube channel, Journeyman Pictures, and they were showing these interviews with all these people and how they were talking about the Trump inauguration, where they showed the actual photographs. Like, this was photographic evidence to people they showed. And 15% of people who saw the photos still believed that there were more people at the Trump inauguration looking at a photograph that clearly shows it.
Right. No, our confirmation bias is huge. And I was actually just writing about this because Goodreads asked me to write sort of updates on the Bible book as the Constitution book. And there's a line by a poet who said, "We both read the Bible day and night. You see black and I see white." And I feel that that's sort of a poetic way to say that confirmation bias exists. That when we read something, we see what we want to see, and it's very hard for us to change our mind. And weirdly, my Bible book was an example of confirmation bias because people would write me emails, hundreds of emails from secular people saying, thank you for showing me how crazy religion is. You know, you really did a job. And then religious people, same amount, hundreds would say, thank you for reaffirming my faith and showing the good in religion. So it was hilarious to see. Yeah. But to your question of can we change it? I am optimistic that there are ways that we can change our mind. One of them I talked about last time is adopting the puzzle mindset. So when you go to talk to someone who's on the opposite side of the political spectrum, instead of seeing it as a debate, as a war, try to envision it as a puzzle. Why do we disagree? Mm. Why do we believe what we believe? Is there evidence that I can present or that she can present that would make us change our mind? And if we do still disagree, where can we go from there? Is there still some joint action we can take that will make the world better? So all of these things. And then just another thing we need to do in culture is start to value the when people say, oh, I was wrong, that's seen as a sort of a badge of shame. It should be a badge of honor. It should be like, congratulate, you are a hero for admitting you're wrong. But you know, that you made a mistake. I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. That if I'm looking at a website or a news source that never admits they're wrong, then I'm like, this is a very bad way to go about processing information because we're all wrong some of the time.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that also struck me was how funny this was. Like, you literally lived as if it was the era of the Constitution. This is one of my favorite quotes from the book. You said, when I told my wife, Julie, that I planned to live for a year constitutionally, muskets, quill pens, and all, her reaction was not huzzah. She was no fan of my year of living biblically. For starters, she hated the beard. She didn't kiss me for 7 months. Is that true? She didn't actually kiss you? And then No. She said, I'm not going to churn butter.
She did say that. And she never had to. She never had to. But she did have to do other things. I did get her in a bonnet and the corset and all of that.
Yeah.
Well, part of the book is sort of looking at the Constitution from a historical point of view that we've talked about. But part of it was living it, because that's what I love to do. So I put on the Tricorn hat. I made 18th century food with cloves, and I wrote with a quill pen, and I quartered a soldier, because the Third Amendment says that you don't have to have a soldier stay in your house. That was a big deal back then, because the British would stay in people's houses, the soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also my right, if I consent, to have a soldier stay over. So I had this nice soldier come in, stay for a few days. And I had a musket that I carried around the Upper West Side of New York, which was very mixed reactions. Some people were like, what the hell is going on? I will say it came in handy one time. I was, I arrived at a coffee shop at the same time as this other guy, and he said, you go first. I am not going to mess with a guy holding an 18th century musket. So that was nice. And it's big and heavy. It's 10 pounds.
Yeah.
So that was fascinating. And I will say there was much about 18th century life that we should be so grateful we don't have to, you know, just even doing the dishes. There was no sinks. There was no faucet in the kitchen. You had to lug the water. I tried to replicate it by lugging water from my bathroom into the kitchen. So that's the best I could do. But that said, there were aspects that I think were wonderful. And one of them was writing with a quill pen, which I loved just the sound of this. It had sort of an ASMR sound, like scratch, scratch, scratch. But the best part about it was that I was away from my devices. There were no pings, no dings. There was no temptation to go and click on the internet. It allowed me, I believe, to think much more deeply and much more profoundly about these topics.
Yeah.
And so I am, you know, you don't have to use a quill pen. You can use a pencil, a crayon, a pen, whatever. But I do think writing away from a computer is a wonderful exercise.
Yeah, I mean, you said if the world returned to quills, would we see a decline in trolls and rage writing? Maybe. Or what if the founding fathers had written the Constitution on a shared cloud document? Would they ever come to an agreement? And like, just imagining trying to just, you know, imagine what that might look like today if like, you know, 30 senators were together trying to write an agreement. Like, I think kindergartners would come to an agreement faster than our Congress. Like, that's, you know,
so true.
Just mind-boggling to me. But let's get into some of the core ideas. First, let's talk about voting, because this kind of made me laugh and smile and thought, oh, this is great. You said when George Washington ran for the Virginia State Legislature in 1758, he provided voters with 28 gallons of rum, 50 gallons of rum punch, 34 gallons of wine, 46 gallons of beer, and 2 gallons of hard cider. He won the election with more than 300 well-lubricated votes. So you mentioned that Election Day was like this celebratory thing where everybody was just getting shit-faced, it sounds like.
That's exactly right. And I don't reckon, I mean, first of all, we should not go back totally to 18th century voting. It was sexist and racist and only men could vote. And I also don't think that it should be, you know, like a, you know, a frat party with everyone binge drinking. But I do like the idea that it was very festive. I mean, this, when the country first started, it was amazing to people that they could choose their leaders. This was an awe-inspiring fact, the first time in history that they had a say in their political leaders. So there, it was very festive. It had the, you know, you had music, you had farmers markets, you had cakes. Election cakes were a huge deal, and people would bake them, and they would be massive. Some of them were like 70 pounds, and they would bring them to the polls, and everyone would have cake and trade cake and have a good time. And I think we need to recapture some of that joy and festivity and awe at the idea that we can be a part of democracy. And actually, that was one of the many quests in the book, was that I started Operation Election Cake, and I got people in every one of the 50 states to bake an election cake and bring it to the polls or bring it to their work. And people were so happy to have a little positivity among all the negativity of elections that it really was lovely to see. And people were so grateful, and they were so creative, because people would do, like in Georgia, they made cake with peaches, and in Michigan, cherries. I didn't know cherries were Michigan, but apparently they are. So it was lovely. And there is some evidence. There was a study a few years ago by some Yale political scientists who set up these little parties, festivals, and with music, and it increased voter turnout by 7%. So it's just a better way to look at democracy, as instead of this chore and this horrible thing that, you know, oh my God, let's look at it. This is amazing. We can participate in choosing our leaders. That is unusual in the history of the world, and you know, still in many countries around the world now.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when you mentioned that, it made me think back to a trip that I took to Tijuana with a friend. And one of my friends always teases me. He said, let me get this straight. It's 4th of July weekend and you're going to go celebrate by leaving the country. I'm like, but we get there, and the funniest thing, you know, we've driven like 9 hours from Berkeley. We had a friend, and we get into a bar, and the guy's like, no alcohol. And we're like, get us a beer. And he's like, no, no alcohol. And we're like, what the hell? I'm like, why? He was like, because Mexican elections are happening, and if we serve alcohol, nobody votes. I think, which is kind of funny to think, like, yeah.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, I had never heard that before, but it reminded me of that when you said, you know, that elections were festive.
Yeah. Well, I guess they had to rearrange it so you could only get a drink after you voted. Like, that was your reward.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the secret for that. Yeah, I did bring rum punch, and I'm going to do it again in November, and this time I'm going without the rum punch, because one of the election workers asked me for rum punch, and I didn't know what to do. Like, are they allowed to have rum? And I was like, well, she's an adult, so I guess I have to give it to her. So
yeah.
I hope I didn't skew the election that way.
Well, you know, I think the other thing that struck me was voting by voice. Like you said, you tried to do that, and that wasn't acceptable?
Well, yes, this was fascinating to learn that the secret ballot was not the way they voted in early America. Most people voted by voice. You would arrive at the poll and then you would say out loud, sometimes in front of a crowd, I want to vote for X or Y. And in one sense, it was very embarrassing because I did it. I went into my New York City cafeteria of a public school and I said, I'd like to vote for Kathy Hochul for governor. I said it right out loud. And the woman who worked at the polls was like, shh, 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 you can't say that. That is not allowed. And I said, well, that's the way our founding fathers voted. She said, times have changed. So I can no longer vote by voice. The advantage of voting by voice is, I suppose, to take the taboo off. I don't recommend it because I don't want voter intimidation and people to feel like they have to vote one way or the other. But I do like the idea that, you know, votes should not be like hemorrhoids. They should not be something we're ashamed of. It's, you know, in an ideal democracy, you should be loud and proud and say, I'm voting for this and this is the reason why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes a perfect segue to talking about free speech. You said the free speech that we know is mostly a modern phenomenon. The founding fathers meant something vastly different when they talked about free speech. And you say it was more restricted back then. At the time of our country's founding, free speech meant books, letters, pamphlets, newspapers, and chats at the local tavern. It did not mean viral tweets or doxing or ratioing. The framers wanted speed bumps. Speech should be refined by literate and educated people such as newspaper editors. Now, you're a longtime writer, a longtime journalist, and it's kind of funny because in one way, the internet has been a blessing because right. People like me are able to produce shows like this with virtually no formal training. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think we democratize the ability to speak, but I also think that it had downsides that most of us never anticipate. Basically, I think the framers of the Constitution thought about speed bumps. Clearly, the people who built the internet didn't think twice about it.
Oh, that is such a great point. Exactly. There are pros and cons. I am generally a very strong free speech supporter. So it was very interesting to see that the founders were not what I would consider big free speech advocates. And it depended on the founding father, but the state laws at the time there were blasphemy laws. I tried to reinstitute that for my family.
Yeah. That was hilarious. So you gotta tell me about that. Like your blasphemy laws with the kids.
Yeah. Blasphemy and cursing in New York State. It was every time you cursed or said damn or you had to pay 37.5 cents. That was the fine to the government. And I tried to reinstitute that and I thought I'm going to make a lot of money. My kids were able to weasel out of it. They're like, I don't have a half cent. So let's just wait until I get to, 75 cents. But then they would curse again and get to 112 and have. So it was a nightmare. But it was fascinating to see that that there was much more of a concern about, there was much more of a sense that people should not be allowed to say whatever they want. And this was interesting because their notions of rights were very different than ours. We now tend to think of rights as more absolute. Like, I have the right to free speech and that's it. But they believed we are born with natural rights, but once we enter a society with other people, we've entered a social contract and our rights must be balanced against the common good. And often the common good would win. So it was really interesting to see. And one of my takeaways was I do like the idea of this one constitutional scholar talks about we should have in a modern democratic pluralistic society, we should have a lot of rights, more rights than we think we have, more than just the ones mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but they should be not as strong. They should be balanced. You have a right to free speech, but I have a right to watch a play and not be disturbed by people shouting about whatever they're protesting. So you've got to balance the rights. It's a much more about balancing than it is about rights as total trump cards.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, you also wrote about the Sedition Act, and you actually said that Congress passed the 1798 Sedition Act, a law that undoubtedly considered perfectly constitutional. The Sedition Act said that Americans could be punished for false, scandalous, and malicious statements against the government, and it resulted in dozens of prosecutions. If that were the case today, literally every journalist that wrote a single thing during the Trump presidency would be in jail, right?
Oh, yeah. And what about late-night talk show hosts? They would be overflowing with people who committed sedition, according to this. They were serious. There was one man, a Massachusetts man, who was thrown in jail because he made an ass joke about John Adams. John Adams was the one who was behind the Sedition Act, and he came to a celebration, and there were all of this pomp and circumstance. There were these cannons that went off to celebrate his presence. And this guy made a joke, like, you know, not a great joke, but he said, "I wish the cannonball would go right up his arse." And someone overheard it, reported it, and he went to jail. It wasn't Stalin Russia, but it was not what we picture today as free speech. And I am very grateful for the 21st century notion of free speech. And I am worried that it's being from all sides that we're getting pressure to have more restricted speech. It's a complicated issue, and I see the pros and cons, but I am very grateful we don't live in John Adams America.
Yeah, and apparently you tweeted to somebody that they violated the Sedition Act.
I did. I felt it was my duty. That was part of my duty, was to inform people when I felt they were doing something that might be considered unconstitutional. And the other one, I didn't follow up too much, but there was a Connecticut law in the early 1800s that banned jugglers and magicians and gymnasts, or people who could, I think they distort their body or something like that. So yeah, I happen to like magic, but if I were a magic hater, I could whip that law out and say, listen, this is un-American.
Well, let's talk about privacy, because you say that basically the Fourth Amendment originally applied to just physical objects such as paper and ink documents, but now includes the contents of your smartphone. And I thought about that, and it just, like, it made me think of the Patriot Act in terms of, I mean, there's literally, isn't the government basically allowed to go and just, you know, seize your home with no search and seizure, like with no warrant?
Yeah, it's a problem. I think the problem is, I feel that one person now can do so much more damage than they could back then. So in the 1700s, what could, you know, you there were bombs, so you could blow something up, but there were not nuclear bombs. They were not dirty bombs. They were not bio weapons. So the stakes are higher, and I don't know the answer. It is, again, it's a balance of the right to privacy versus the right to live and feel some safety in society. And it's a, it's a complicated, I don't have an answer. I have answers. I am going to go with, like Ben Franklin said, that the older I get, the less sure I am of my opinions. I feel strong opinions about some areas, but this idea of privacy, I don't know what to make of it. What do you make of it?
I'm with you. It's kind of a tough one. It's like you say, you know, like somebody could be sitting in at their computer. I thought about this in the context of AI when I was like, there are obviously safeguards. Like, you can't put, I need the schematics for a bomb into ChatGPT. But I'm like, okay, let's say I'm writing a new pilot for a new season of 24 to bring it back. And I need the schematic for a bomb.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What do you do with that? I mean, a lot of free speech is premised on the idea that the truth will win, that the truth, if everyone is allowed to say their lies, their falsehood, their dis and misinformation, and also the truth is going to win, the marketplace of ideas and the best. Now, what worries me is that I think that sometimes the falsehoods, the conspiracies win, because they're more fun. It's more fun to believe that there's a secret cabal controlling the world than that it's, you know, sort of messy chaos at the top and no one knows what they're doing. So I am worried that the marketplace of ideas does not work, but I don't know what the options, what else there is. So I still am a fan of the marketplace of ideas. And I just hope that the truth, if we can make it interesting enough, if we can sell it, if we can get people to be okay with the truth, which is often nuanced and complicated and sometimes a little boring, we've got to as a society start to embrace that instead of like the exciting, flashy conspiracy theories, which are more fun to believe.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court. You said that basically the Supreme Court meets every year from October to June or July and agrees to hear about 100 to 150 cases. You can observe the oral arguments in person if you can secure one of the 439 seats in the courtroom. Most are taken up by lawyers, journalists, VIPs, and people involved in the case, but 50 spots are reserved for the public. And you say that today's SCOTUS is undoubtedly not what the founders had imagined. First of all, whenever I think about something that is being heard by the Supreme Court, I imagine it's some sort of high profile case. Is that always true, or are there a lot of things we don't hear about that are just completely irrelevant?
Oh yeah, no, there's tons of cases that you will never hear of, and it's the high profile ones, of course, that get all. I wanted to go to the Supreme Court because they are the ones in our current system who decide what is and is not constitutional. So you can wait in line. I got up at 3 a.m. I stayed at a hotel in D.C. and I waited in line for 6 hours. And I was outraged because there was apparently you can hire someone to be a professional line waiter for you for $200 and then just waltz in at 9 a.m., which I found like this is supposed to be the bastion of equality and fairness and justice. And this did not seem fair, this system. Maybe I was just annoyed that I didn't hire someone and didn't find out about it. But I got in there, and one thing that struck me is just the way that the building looks. And it looks like a Roman temple, that we should be sacrificing oxen to these gods in black robes. And this was because William Howard Taft, in the 1920s, he was Chief Justice. He wanted a building to rival the White House and the Capitol. But that is not the way the founders envisioned the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was very much the third among three. It was not meant to be as powerful as it is today. And it has gone out, in my opinion, and many scholars' opinions, the idea that these 9 unelected people have so much say over where we go to college, over who we can hire, who we can marry, where we can worship. It's crazy that this system, and it's not what the founders envisioned. The founders envisioned the much smaller, humble court that it was on the second floor of a building where there were butchers and markets. And it was meant to have some say in what is constitutional, but the other branches should be in there too. The president, the Congress, and Supreme Court all work together and weigh in on what they think is constitutional. Now what we have is judicial supremacy, where everyone thinks, oh, the Supreme Court has final say. That is not what most of the founding fathers would have agreed to. And this is according to some of the best scholars that I interviewed, like Jonathan Gnapp of Stanford, who I think is brilliant. So, yeah, I think the Supreme Court it's out of control. And the very least we should have term limits, that you should only be allowed to serve for 18 years. The idea that you can be on there for 40 years until your 90s and deciding cases about, AI in your 90s, and when you barely know how to use a cell phone, it's insanity.
Yeah. Well, this is another thing you mentioned was cruel and unusual punishment. And I noticed you didn't write much about prison in this book, but you got me when, just going back, like looking at that. I don't know if you've ever seen Michael Moore's Where to Invade Next documentary. It's really fascinating. He goes to all these different countries to look at their various social policies to bring them back to the United States. He kind of just jokes. He's like, we fucked everything up. So he's like, I'm going to go to Western countries and see, and he goes to places like in Slovenia, college is completely free. Mm. And when they tried to put tuition in, the students around the world revolted. Of course, in the United States, nobody does a damn thing.
Right.
But one of the things he does is he goes to a prison in Norway, a maximum security facility. And he's talking to the warden of the prison, and he looks at him and says, I don't get it. Like, where is the punishment? He was like, they're living on an island. They're cooking. He's talking to a murderer. There's a guy, behind him. They all live in houses. Like, you look at it. And he said, I don't get what the punishment is here. And he said, the purpose of this is to take away their freedom, not to dehumanize them. Mm-hmm. The warden said something that stayed with me. He said, I don't understand why this idea is so odd to you, because it is actually one of your own ideas, no cruel or unusual punishment.
Mm.
Yet, if we look at, honestly, I think of all the things that would make me kill myself, if I knew that I was going to spend time in prison, I'd be like, you know what, the hell with it. I'm going to kill myself. That sounds like way more like pleasant than going to prison.
Interesting. Well, I think I love that you say that. I think a lot of the founding fathers were very interested in reform as opposed to punishment. I mean, there are two main reasons to put someone in jail or to punish them. One is sort of this revenge and to, you know, and the other is deterrence and reform and trying to make sure they never do it again. And these men were men of the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment was the first time in history where people said, oh, we shouldn't be doing this purely out of revenge to make them suffer because they made someone else suffer. We should be doing it to try to make them better. And it's interesting because they were progressive and reformists, and yet they were in the 18th century. So their reforms to us seem barbaric. Like Thomas Jefferson proposed that gay people should be castrated instead of killed. And this was like, wow, what a liberal progressive policy. But to them, this was a step forward. But yeah, I think that we have lost some of that idea that punishment should not just be for vent. I think it should almost completely be for reform and for making the world better, because You can't take back the bad things that they've done. So let's just try to make sure that people don't do it in the future.
Yeah, it's funny. I was watching Con Air with my cousin the other night, and they quoted Dostoevsky, where he says, "You can." I'm paraphrasing, so you know you'll have to check me on the exact wording. But he said, "You know, Dostoevsky said that you can judge the dignity of a society by the way it treats its prisoners after he had served some time."
That's a great quote. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you can tell someone on a date how they treat the wait staff. I feel there's something there. maybe not a metaphor. Maybe
no, I'm with you on that. That's definitely a good lamb. Yeah, good test. Well, okay. So I think the other thing I want to talk about. Let's talk about race, because clearly, you know, slavery was allowed at this time, and obviously that's absurd. And even the 13th Amendment, there was a documentary about this where they profiled all these people, and the way, you know, like the basic sort of idea was it was a way to get around racism and still put lots of black people in jail, as we saw in the 80s, because the, you know, punishments for crack were like the sentences for crack were substantially higher than those for cocaine.
Right. Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, it was a racist time, and there were people, delegates, who owned enslaved people. So I have a chapter on race, and one of my heroes is Frederick Douglass, and I spoke to a great black professor who had deep thoughts on race. And what I like about Douglass is he was, there were two ways. He was around the Civil War. He was an abolitionist and a former enslaved person. So there are two ways you can look at the Constitution. You can look at it and say, all right, well, this was written by these, some of them were owned enslaved people, so let's burn it. That it is a deal with the devil. And that is what one of the most famous abolitionists at the time, William Lloyd Garrison, said. He said, this is a document from the devil. He literally burned it in front of a crowd. He burned the Constitution. Initially, Frederick Douglass was with him and said, yes, this, we got to get completely rid of the Constitution. But Douglass changed his mind. He decided to take another tack, which was, let's look at the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, as promissory notes, because they have language. Even though the people who signed it, some of them were hypocrites, it talks about liberty and equality and freedom. So let's make the Constitution live up to its promises. So instead of envisioning it as a deal with the devil, let's look at it as a promissory note that people will be equal and treated regardless of race. And this is the language that was adopted by Martin Luther King and by Obama in a great speech on race, that we have to make America live up to the promises that it made in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And I love that way of looking at it. I just think it's dangerous to try to start over with a new constitution, because who knows what will result. You know, there are some groups who want to return all the rights to the states, and so it could go that way. It could be a disaster. So let's try to make the Constitution live up to its best parts, just like Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass advise.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about petitions and amendments. Like, how does this even work? Because, like, when was the last? You know, I had ChatGPT just read a quick summary of the 15 amendments for me, so I could reference them. But, like, I don't even, you know, this is absurd, but I don't know when the last amendment to the Constitution was and what it was.
Oh, I'll tell you. It's been a while. I actually interviewed the guy who was behind it. It's a fascinating story. I won't get into it now, but it was in 1992 was the last time an amendment was ratified. And the amendment was that Congress people cannot give themselves raises. They can only give raises to the next Congress.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Which is good. And actually, it was one that Madison came up with, and it was sort of sitting there like a zombie amendment for 200 years. It had not been rejected or fully accepted. And this guy's like, let's make it accept. But yeah, it is very hard to get an amendment through, which is understandable. We shouldn't be able to willy-nilly change the Constitution, because that's how authoritarianism works. On the other hand, they made it too hard. They didn't realize how hard they were making it. You know, you have to have 2/3 of Congress approve of it and 3/4 of the state legislatures. And there are various other ways, but it's really hard, really hard. And the problem is they didn't foresee parties. They didn't foresee that we'd be stuck with these two major parties that refused to negotiate. So they thought it would be easier to get an amendment through. They knew they had written a flawed document. George Washington said it. He wrote his nephew a couple of weeks after the convention. He says, this is an imperfect document, but they've built in ways to fix it Article 5. But now I am worried we're not going to have an amendment for decades, because we've got such we've got such fractionalization. And I would say the catch 22 is that to fix the amendment process, we have to change the Constitution, and you can't do that with the current amendment process. So it's a bit of a catch 22, but it is one of the hardest constitutions in the world to change. And that is a big problem. And that is why I do believe when we're interpreting the Constitution, we have to have elasticity. You know, we have to look at these words like equal protection and say, yeah, they didn't mean it to apply to gay marriage in 1868, but you know what? Times have changed. Let's make it apply to gay marriage. Because we can't do a constitutional amendment for that. So we have to think of, I like to use a pants metaphor, the Constitution, it should have an elastic waistband. It shouldn't be totally falling down with no structure. There should be some limits and structure, but it shouldn't be a pair of skinny jeans that you gain 2 pounds and you split it wide open. So you have to have these words stretch a little so that the words like liberty and equality mean slightly different things than they did back then.
So one other thing that struck me in the book is you say that imagine if politicians really were just the messengers of people's will. Imagine Ted Cruz saying, well, I don't agree with solar energy, but I've been instructed by my constituents to pass this bill, so I suppose I vote yeah. We basically have a direct democracy, perhaps unworkable, but interesting for sure. Obviously, I think you can imagine where I land on this. Like, I personally don't think politicians do a damn thing in the interest of the people. I mean, they talk a big game,
right?
But I interviewed Andrew Yang, and one of my big reasons to go with him was I was like, I'm a student who's buried in a mountain of student loan debt. I want Andrew Yang to get elected for that one reason alone.
Right.
And then basically the moment this day, I remember as a student, as somebody with debt, when somebody asked Kamala Harris about student loan debt, she said, I'm willing to have a conversation about it. I was like, that's a bullshit answer. That's not an answer. That's a dodge.
Right. Well,
yeah, for me, that summed it up in a nutshell. I was like, okay, you know what? How I'm going to get out of this debt is I'm going to wait for the government to implode.
Interesting. So do you think, would you prefer where people voted more on referenda? So it was more direct democracy instead of elected.
So this brings up an interesting point. And I remember reading about this somewhere. I think it was a book called Superintelligence. It's like, why do you have an electoral college? And it's like, okay, you're right. There are probably things that people like you and I have no business on voting on because we don't know anything about it.
Right.
Right. So that makes sense. Like that I was like, okay, that kind of explains why we would have an electoral college, which we will get to. We've got to move on from this in the interest of time. So let's do two things. We need to finish this up with talking about gun rights and the electoral college.
Sure. Happy to do.
So guns are without a question, probably one of the most controversial issues, like that is incredibly polarizing.
Yes. And so I have a whole chapter on that. And since I was trying to express my rights in the 1780s way, I went and I got myself a musket. I went on ye old internet and I bought an actual musket from the 1700s and I carried it around, as I said, on the Upper West Side, and I shot it. I joined a group of Revolutionary War reenactors and we went to the shooting range and shot it. Now, what was fascinating about shooting it is such a different experience than shooting a modern gun. You know, a semi-automatic, for instance, you just press the trigger as many times as you want. To shoot a musket is at least 15 steps. You've got to take out a little cartridge, you've got to bite it off, you got to pour the gunpowder down the barrel, you got to pour it into another place, you got to take out the ramrod, ram it down, put the ramrod back. It takes a while. So it is a very different instrument. And it would be hard to do a mass shooting with a musket. So the debate is, and I talked to both sides, I tried to present both sides of the gun rights debate as fairly as possible. One side, I think, makes an interesting point that when they wrote right to bear arms, those arms were muskets. They had other ones and they were developing other ones, but it was a very different machine. So imagine if you wrote a law about wheeled vehicles, vehicles with wheels, and all that there was bicycles. And then a couple hundred years later, we have 18-wheel trucks. What do we do? Do we adjust the law? Yeah, you know, you have to make it different. So that's sort of the progressive argument against having very few restrict. That's the argument that we should be more regulatory with our guns because they are so different than they were in the 1700s.
Yeah. Well, what about the Electoral College? Because there is this part of me, like I said, when I saw that idea that, okay, yeah, there are probably a lot of things that people who have no knowledge should not be voting on, then it makes sense. On the flip side of that, like the popular vote doesn't determine who gets elected, even though that is what the majority of the people said they wanted.
Yeah.
So it kind of doesn't reflect the true interest. It's kind of like there's a term for it. They call it something. Some type of democracy when we have that. I don't remember the exact word. It's somewhere in my notes, but why is it there? Like, I've heard certain things. I also read somewhere that you may be able to correct, like, why is inauguration on in January? It turns out because it took that long for the newly elected president to get to Washington.
Oh, I love that. I hadn't heard that.
I don't know how true that
actually,
is.
Actually, I'm going to look into that. Yeah, I am not a fan of the Electoral College. I think that is one of the they had some great ideas. As we said, they were experimenters, and this was a compromise that no one actually loved, the Electoral College. But it's what they came up with. And no, some of them didn't want the people to directly elect the president. So they came up with this sort of Frankenstein solution. I think that it is not a good, because as we've seen, you can lose the popular vote and win the presidency. And it's more like a game. It's like, you know, a game of risk than it is like an actual democracy. I think I would like to see us get rid of it. There were many reasons for the Electoral College, but one that I find really interesting and almost ironic now is that they wanted to prevent the people who they thought were often ignorant and easily misled. They wanted to prevent them from electing someone who might turn into a tyrant or an authoritarian.
Ironic.
Yeah, exactly. So they set up this buffer zone where you had these educated electors from every state. So if someone elected a crazy person, if a state elected a crazy person, the electors could be the adults in the room and say, oh no, that's just, this person is not fit to be president. Let's vote for this more rational person. So the idea that it was built to stop a demagogue, and it has actually benefited people who are more demagoguish, is a weird quirk of history.
Well, let's finish this up with two things. I mean, I think that, you know, the core sort of ending of the book is that in a lot of ways, what I got from this was that we take democracy for granted. Like we assume that, you know, this is always going to stay this way. And I think that unless you've spent, you know, an extended period of time in another country, it's hard to fathom the idea that this could go away. Mm-hmm. Like you could see it go away.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, yeah, reading about the history, you can see that it is not the natural state. You know, we have to fight for it. Part of the book starts and ends with a parable about that Ben Franklin told at the Constitutional Convention. Because at the convention, George Washington sat in this wooden chair, and on the back of the chair was a carving of the sun, but only half the sun. So you couldn't see the bottom half of the sun. So you didn't know, was it rising or was it setting? And at the end of the convention, when they finally, against all odds, created this document that everyone signed, Ben Franklin said, I decided at the end, it is a rising sun. America, the future of America is rising. The future of democracy is rising. And so I was, one question I tried to answer, is the sun still rising on America, on our republic? And my answer is, I don't know. It's up to us. It's not like a sun where it's controlled by gravity. It's controlled by us. And it's fragile. So we have to be the ones who go out there and keep democracy going. And it could be little things like baking a democracy cake, which we talked about. It could be trying to urge structural change, like get rid of gerrymandering or get rid of the supermajority in the Senate, which we didn't talk about, but was not in the Constitution. So all of these things we've got to really engage. Because it's very tempting, and I feel the temptation all the time to just disengage and say, oh, they're all a bunch of crooks. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to give up. Nothing ever changes. But things do change. It's just who is the one changing it?
Yeah. Amazing. Well, as always, you have been fabulous, and I want to finish my final question. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, I love that question. And I thought about it. I mean, one thing is that it's interesting because we've talked about the importance of mistakes and how it's good to experiment and do mistakes. So in one sense, I think paradoxically, this is almost like a Cohen, like being able to admit your mistakes makes you unmistakable, makes you extraordinary. So I would say that's my little, paradoxical answer, that we should all embrace our imperfections and our mistakes and be proud when we change our mind to and admit that we were wrong, and admit that we made mistakes, then we can become unmistakable.
Incredible. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with everybody. Where can people find out more about you, the new book, and everything else that you're up to?
First of all, thank you. I love your show. I love your thoughts. And I'm honored to be on. The book is out. It's called The Year of Living Constitutionally. And I've got ajjacobs.com as my website and ajjacobs on all the socials. And that's it. Would love to interact and want people to bake cakes. So join my movement.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.